Good afternoon, and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and your chair for today. Today's program, The North American Idea, the Vision for a Continental Future, is co-sponsored with the Club's Business and Leadership Forum. We also welcome our listening audience, and we invite everyone to visit us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Dr. Robert A. Pastor is Professor of International Relations and Founder and Director of the Center for North American Studies and Founder and Co-Director of the Center for Democracy and Election Management at American University. He has a combined career in government, academe, and non-governmental organizations and has become one of the most widely known and regarded analysts of North America. His most recent book, which is also the topic of our program today, The North American Idea, A Vision of a Continental Future. Dr. Pastor was Director of Latin American and Caribbean Affairs on the National Security Council from 1977 to 1981. He's also a consultant to the State and Defense Departments and was nominated by President Bill Clinton to be ambassador to Panama. He was a senior foreign policy advisor to every Democratic presidential candidate since 1976. And as vice chair of the Council on Foreign Relations Task Force on the Future of North America in 2005, he helped draft a report, Building a North American Community, which has set the terms for the post-NAFTA debate. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert A. Pastor.
Thank you very much, Linda. Thank all of you for coming out on what is a glorious day in San Francisco. And thanks for the very generous introduction. I always compare those introductions to one that William Howard Taft, American president, was given by the governor of New York, Chauncey Depew. Taft, as many of you may know, was a man of exceptional brilliance and girth. He was over 400 pounds, and Chauncey Depew was known as a very eloquent and flowery speechmaker. And in his long introduction to Taft, he concluded by saying, "This is a man, our president, who is pregnant with integrity and courage." Taft got up and said, "If it's a boy, I'm going to name it Courage. And if it's a girl, I'm going to name it Integrity. And if it's just gas, I'm going to name it Chauncey Depew." So in comparison, Linda, you've given a wonderful introduction, and I appreciate that. Yogi Berra, a great Yankee catcher who's gone on to become a great philosopher king, who has managed to combine in his very succinct comments both brilliance and stupidity with a certain measure of humor, once said, "You can see a lot just by looking." And the truth is, however, that we can't see North America because we haven't really looked. All that we tend to see in North America is a geographical expression. We understand that our two neighbors are very dependent on us, to the tune of 40% of their gross national product is involved in trade with the United States. But because of that dependence, we tend to either ignore or take for granted our neighbors. We don't see that we are also very dependent on our neighbors, that our two most important markets for our exports in the world are not China and Japan, they are Canada and Mexico. That our two most important sources of energy imports in the world are not Saudi Arabia and Venezuela. They happen to be Canada and Mexico. Two-thirds of all of the people who visit the United States as tourists are Canadians and Mexicans, and in fact, two-thirds of Americans who go abroad visit Canada and Mexico. More than one-third of the migrants in the United States are Canadians and Mexicans as well. So there is a degree of social and economic interconnectedness that not only implies a degree of dependence on the part of our neighbors on us, but also of us on them. This failure, absolute failure to take into account this mutual dependence, means that we pay a very high price, though it's not always noticed. We pay a high price on the border through a variety of inefficiencies. We pay a high price in missing opportunities, such as President Obama missed when he gave his address just a week and a half ago on jobs. Instead of urging Americans to think about North American jobs, because our jobs are so often interconnected, we don't produce American cars in this country. We produce North American cars. Parts are coming back and forth 7 or 8 times between Canada and Mexico. And when they're finished, it's not so easy to find the degree to which it's a Canadian or Mexican car. And so the very suggestion that we can cure our auto industry, as Steve Rattner, the president's auto czar, said, by simply saving American jobs and ignoring our two neighbors, was ridiculous. We miss not only opportunities, but we make mistakes. Because in that same address, because there is no sense of North America in our collective unconscious, he again introduced, President Obama again introduced, a Buy American provision in the Jobs Act that was sent to Congress. Well, the last time he did that, in the first stimulus package, it led to 2 years of court cases and very riled feelings by the Canadians in particular, who ultimately got it excised through a new agreement between Canadian and Mexican provinces and states. But even the same administration has repeated the same mistake again, and the Canadians last Thursday reintroduced a protest in the World Trade Organization and also diplomatically to the U.S. So we pay a high price, we miss opportunities, we make a lot of mistakes. So the time really has come to rethink what we understand is North America and how it should be incorporated into our political and policy consciousness. Albert Einstein, who incidentally didn't ever play baseball to my mind, once said, however, a great thought begins by seeing something differently with a shift of the mind's eyes. The truth is that when we look at our neighbors, we see differences. We rarely see the shared values, the shared issues, the shared concerns. And indeed, today, our new agenda, which is no longer a NAFTA agenda, it's a North American agenda, is composed to an extraordinary extent by new transnational issues. Issues that we had previously thought were wholly domestic in scope, but in fact we can't solve alone anymore, and in which the consequences of us trying to solve it alone only reintroduces the problem, again, as a chronic problem, and creates bad feelings among our neighbors who need to contribute to solve it. Immigration, energy, we can't solve those two issues alone. If we try, we will find ourselves with real problems. In energy right now, the biggest challenge we face is how do you reduce carbon emissions? At the same time, how do you promote energy production for increasing growth? None of the three countries can solve this by themselves, but together we could go a long way towards solving both problems. Canada has enormous energy resources, as does Mexico. The United States wastes a great deal of energy. We introduced carbon emission standards on a state-by-state basis rather than on a national basis. But until we think about solving this continentally, firms and others will take advantage of the differences between our two countries' policies. So we need to think of a new way to address these transnational issues. And we need to understand the shared interests we have in them. Vicente Fox, who won the first genuinely free election in Mexican history in 2000, liked to say that my grandfather galloped down from Ohio and found his American dream in Guanajuato. The whole idea that we can find an American dream in the center of Mexico is the kind of thought that we need to have our leaders have periodically, if not regularly. So that's what my book is about, how to shift the mind's eye to see North America as a vision of what our three countries could become, rather than a source of continued division. But in the course of the book, I take it back historically and try to divine the origin of the North American idea. And I take it back 65 million years ago, which is, of course, before any of us were born. But it's when North America started, as a result of a huge meteor, 6 miles wide, traveling 60,000 miles a minute from the beginning of time. It crashed into the Yucatan Peninsula with the force of a 100-megaton explosion, creating a huge wave of fire that barbecued all of the dinosaurs in North America, and that reshaped geologically North America into a continent. Up until that time, it was two thin islands. And after that, the sea came out, the land started to create, the great mountain range that extends majestically from Alaska and Canada all the way down to Mexico and beyond, and the river systems that were created as a result of that, flowing mostly north and south, created an absolutely magnificent North America, rich with minerals, rich with land, and from the sky, it looks as if it's one continent. But of course, 30,000 years ago, people came to North America, largely from Asia. And over that period of time, they built up several civilizations, the main one being in the Mexican City Plateau area, so that when Christopher Columbus discovered America, he actually found a population that may have been as large as 30 million people, with a civilization as rich and as advanced as any of that in Europe at the time. But three Western colonial heritages implanted themselves in North America, the Spanish in the south, in Mexico, extending north, the English in the middle and the north, and the French as well. And they created significant differences. The colonial heritage in North America had a very important difference in the way in which they were ruled, in the way in which the people in the three countries looked at each other. Independence in the 18th and 19th century accentuated those differences, made the horizontal divide much deeper. And, of course, the growing power of the United States made our two neighbors much more wary of American power and influence and much more determined to raise barriers to trade, to investment, and mostly to influence from the United States. And that defined the three countries right up until the mid-1980s, at which point the Canadians first and then the Mexicans a few years later began to realize that those walls that they had created between their countries and the United States were no longer serving their interests, that their interests meant integrating into a larger unit, creating a larger market. And that led to the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was signed in 1992. Now, the North American Free Trade Agreement subsequently, as I wrote today in San Francisco Chronicle, morphed into a pinata for pandering pundits and politicians, from Bill O'Reilly and Lou Dobbs to our current President and Secretary of State. But the truth is that NAFTA was a dramatic success for what it was intended to do. It was intended to dismantle trade and investment barriers. It largely did that. And within 7 short years, this market tripled in size. Trade among the three countries tripled. The rate of growth of trade was about 23% a year. Foreign direct investment quintupled among the three countries. The fears that all three countries had about NAFTA were first, the American fear is we would lose jobs, that great sucking sound that Ross Perot talked about. But the truth is that during the period of the most rapid growth in trade among the three countries coincided with the period of the most rapid growth in jobs in the United States. Canadians and Mexican fears were a little different. They were fearful when we lowered investment barriers, the United States would buy their whole country, all of their assets. What really happened was a flow of foreign direct investment came into all three countries. The share of foreign direct investment in Canada and Mexico declined. So that fear also turned out to be false. But the hopes that all three countries had also didn't pan out. Mexico was hoping that NAFTA would lift it to the first world, and they were prepared to pay the price. Indeed, they paid the highest price of integration among the three because they were the most protected. The Canadians hoped that the United States would finally accept international juridical decisions affecting their trade instead of just opting out, as we often had, from doing that. But unfortunately, that proved to be not the case. We had a two-decade struggle on softwood lumber, which is not completely over, just as we had a two-decade struggle on Mexican trucks, a clear violation of the NAFTA agreement, which hopefully now is beginning to be solved, but this is not the first time it was almost beginning to be solved. So we shall await that. And the United States hoped that NAFTA would mean an end to illegal migration, undocumented migration. So neither the fears nor the hopes came true. But if you focus explicitly on what the objectives of NAFTA were, they succeeded in terms of trade investment. But by 2001, however, it turns out that North America peaked. And I hadn't fully grasped just how sharp the downward spiral from 2001 was until I started really working on the book and doing the research, and I included 20 tables of graphs and statistics for those who may be so inclined, but I put them at the end so that they won't interrupt the narrative too much. But the data is pretty overwhelming and scary. Even from trade, the rate of trade growth from 2001 to the present declined by two-thirds. The rate of investment, direct investment increase went from 18 to 23% down to 8 to 11%, so almost half of that. The rate of legal travelers going into the to the United States, which had soared from 418 million a year to 437, declined by 43%, down to 220 million. So there was a significant decline with a real effect on tourism in the United States, just from our two neighbors, and a significant effect on integration of all kinds among the three countries. So the question is, what caused this decline? I think the first reason was obvious, and that was 9/11. The 9/11 raised new barriers on both borders higher than the NAFTA tariff had eliminated. I think the second reason was Chinese competition. China joined the World Trade Organization, and they actually became the largest exporters into all three countries in a very short period of time. Though we are exporting three times more to Mexico each year than we do to China, the imports, of course, as we all know, are very, very one-sided from China. I think, thirdly, we made a significant strategic mistake similar to what Europe had made, which is we widened rather than deepened. That is to say, we reached out to free trade agreements with a lot of other countries all over the world, mostly smaller countries, not terribly significant from a trade or economic standpoint for the United States or even for our two neighbors, as it turned out. But it also seduced us into thinking that we're improving trade when the real ways to improve trade were to deepen integration with Canada and Mexico, to move from a free trade area, for example, to a common external tariff, which would eliminate, in effect, a tax of about 15% on all of our trade, and therefore further integrate our trade. The key thing to understand about our trade with North America, as opposed to the rest of the world, is that almost 50% of our trade is value-added, which means that for every good we import from our two neighbors, almost half of that is made up of our exports to them. In other words, We trade products with the rest of the world, but with North America, we make products jointly. So that if we're really interested in doubling our trade and increasing our economy, the best way to do it is to deepen integration with our two neighbors. That benefits us, frankly, more. But we're still thinking in the old days of trade deficits. Trade deficits are important with China, where they don't import very much from us. But they are not significant in North America, where a significant portion of that trade is coming from us to begin with. So we made a mistake on that. We made a mistake in not investing in infrastructure. We tripled trade. 80% of that trade goes by truck. We didn't build one new road. We made a mistake, fundamentally, in reverting to dual bilateralism after NAFTA. NAFTA had an implicit vision of three countries of North America. But after NAFTA, we began negotiating again between the U.S. and Mexico and U.S. Canada. These are very asymmetric, imbalanced negotiations which rarely achieve very much because we tend to ignore them. We ignore them not because we don't care about our neighbors, because the presidents do. We ignore them because there's usually a special interest at stake, an economic interest. And weighing that economic interest against free, good relations with neighbors, the economic interest almost always wins. So the major reason, I think, that we failed since 2001, however, is that we stopped imagining what North America could do. And our three governments never created a vision together or a set of policies on how to pursue that. And integrating a North American market is a little bit like riding a bicycle. If you stop pedaling, you fall down. You have to keep going. You have to keep pushing forward on it. And we've stopped doing that. So where do we go from here? There's two paths from here. One is the traditional path that Americans take, practical, pragmatic, incremental. Let's find a small problem, let's solve it, let's build on it. And George W. Bush actually tried to do that in 2005. And they started very simply. They started by talking about regulatory convergence, which is a new issue on our agenda, a very important one for integrating our economies. And they started with two products that were very important to our leaders. Our Secretary of Commerce, Carlos Gutierrez, had been CEO from Kellogg's. His principal obsession was to harmonize our regulations on Cheerios. When he was head of Kellogg's, they had to close down their Cheerios factories in order to put two little ingredients in and then export it to Canada. And then after having exported to Canada, they started up the factory again. They took the two ingredients out and had to export it to the United States. This is silly. This is stupid. Those ingredients were trivial, unimportant. Why not have one regulation on what Cheerios could be? That was his principle. He was in charge of this task force. And the Canadians rapidly came into it because Stephen Harper, his principal concern was coming up with a single regulation on his favorite candy, jelly beans. So they started on jelly beans and Cheerios, and 5 years later, they still haven't reached a harmonized regulation for either one. And those were the simple ones. They were more difficult negotiations that went on to try to come up with a standardized regulation on the size of trucks. They missed it by 6 inches and gave up and threw up their hands. Pre-clearance facilities between Buffalo and Ontario, 5 years later, they said it's impossible, we can't do it. There are multiple examples of simple, practical problems that have utterly failed to be solved. And the reason I concluded is very simple. You actually have to start with an idea. You have to start with an idea that says we have a broad national interest in the United States. Our three countries have a continental-wide interest in solving these problems together and in explaining to our people why it's necessary to overrule the Teamsters and why it's necessary to overrule the jelly bean factories in Ontario. Because if you don't have a big idea that can mobilize public opinion, then you can't even solve the little problems. And the real benefit of a paradigm shift, change in our consciousness is that it actually will solve three huge problems and therefore place North America back in a powerful position to compete against China and Europe and the world in the future. The first challenge, the paramount challenge in North America, is how do you narrow the income gap between Mexico and its northern neighbors? This could be done. Actually, the Europeans have shown how to narrow the income gap. It wouldn't be that hard to do if we've really focused on it. Second, and one way to do that, and it would be very simple, is that the three leaders should first task their secretaries of transportation to come up with a continental-wide plan for a North American plan for infrastructure and transportation. Because if you have a large market, as President Eisenhower discovered, you need roads, because 80% of the trade is going over roads. You need roads. And frankly, the implicit development model in NAFTA has actually encouraged undocumented migration to the United States. It's done so because it's encouraged factories, a large amount of manufacturing factories, to invest in the border area. And in the border area, it serves as a magnet to bring up all of the labor from the southern part of Mexico. They work for 1 year. There's 100% turnover. They learn how to work in American factories, and they also learn if they can cross the border, they can make 8 or 10 times as much in a day, which is a very powerful magnet. And I've asked the factories, why don't you invest in the South? It's the same labor, only you could much cheaper wages. And the answer is no infrastructure, no communications, no roads to there. So if we can build this road from Windsor, Ontario, all the way down to Chiapas, the investors will come. And that will help to solve not only the income gap, but the migration challenge in the United States and the trade objectives of the United States. I think, secondly, for the Canadians, they have an opportunity to construct lean advisory international institutions, which could be an alternative model to the supranational intrusive institutions of Europe. See, what North America did is it made the opposite mistake of Europe. Europe over-institutionalized, and we created no real institutions at all. Canadians are actually good at this, but for reasons that are a little bit opaque. In the one region that matters most to them, they haven't done anything. They haven't even tried to do that. And finally, the challenge that matters most to us is it can create for us a new style of leadership. When we emerged from the Second World War, the United States understood under Roosevelt the necessity of constructing a completely different international system, one based on the end of colonialism, one based on self-determination, one based on collective security. It was the premise of those institutions that would prevent another major war among the great powers. And the truth is, it's actually worked for that purpose. We created an International Monetary Fund. We created General Agreements on Tariff and Trade, which is now a World Trade Organization. Created an architecture of international institutions that has served the world well for peace, for economic development. But we've been deadbeat dad since then. We haven't really taken care of these children that Roosevelt created. We haven't recognized that it took two decades or more to create these institutions and the idea behind these institutions. We need now to think of new institutions, leaner advisory that can serve up regional proposals for the three countries. And to do so, we need to be able to adjust our interests to take into account our neighbors' interests. We need to be able to show the world that we're prepared to treat our neighbors with complete respect despite the asymmetry in power. If we did that, then I think we would be well positioned, to lead in the 21st century. Now, is this idea that we're talking about today practical? Is it going to happen anytime soon? And the answer is pretty obvious by the turnout today. It's not there yet. It may be a compelling idea, but people are not thinking of it. It's not in our consciousness. But, you know, some of the greatest ideas, and I'm not necessarily attributing this to one of the greatest, but some of the greatest ideas that seemed so obvious afterwards took a very long time for the world to absorb. I'll start with slavery. In 1788, William Wilberforce in the British Parliament stood up and said, we should end the slave trade. This is immoral. This is wrong. This is not in anybody's interest. Powerful idea. It took only 20 years for the Parliament to finally agree to it. It took us another 51 years after that to ban slavery in the United States. Seneca Falls in 1848, a group of women came together and said, you know, we ought to have a right to vote too. Now, that seems pretty obvious today, but it took 71 years from that moment, that idea, that great idea, to become practical policy. So sometimes it takes a while to get that idea developed and understood. But the importance of getting all three countries to the table is, I cannot understate its importance. From a Mexican standpoint, there's an old adage which they understand very well, and it's, if you don't have a seat at the table, you might very well find yourself on the menu. And the Mexicans understand that very well. So just to conclude, Daniel Burnham, a great Chicago architect, once said, make no little plans, they have no magic to stir men's blood, and probably will not be realized. Make big plans, remembering that a noble logical diagram once recorded will never die, but long after we're gone will be a living thing, asserting itself with ever-growing consistency. When I was in the Peace Corps, there was a palm reader who came to villages, and I was at one village, and he had a long line of people waiting to have their palms read, and my student at the time was first in line, and the palm reader looked at the palm and said, you're going to be poor and powerless until you're 40 years old. And this boy turned white, pale, but then had the wit to say, well, what will happen after that? And the palm reader said, you'll get used to it. And so that's a question for all of us. Will we get used to not understanding or thinking about the North American idea, or will we start to realize that it's not only in our moral interests, it's in our economic and security interests to think differently about our neighbors? Thank you.
Our thanks to Dr. Pastor, author of The North American Idea, The Vision of a Continental Future, for his comments here today. I'm Linda Calhoun, Vice Chair of the Club's International Relations Forum, and I'll be moderating today's audience question period. Dr. Pastor, come have a seat. We have a large number of questions, so let's begin. What are the similarities and differences between your vision for North America and the European Union?
There are a number of very important differences that I think in many ways are more compelling than the similarities. But the first and obvious similarity is that the countries of Europe and the countries of North America have taken steps to try to address historically domestic problems with a more cooperative approach. The differences are very significant. European Union solidarity emerged from two cataclysmic wars in which the major powers in Europe realized that they simply couldn't continue without finding a way to transcend sovereignty and deepen collaboration, first and foremost between France and Germany, but then between all of the nations of Europe. They did so not only to try to avoid a future war, but to compete better against the United States and also to deal better with the threat in Russia. In the case of North America, there was no compelling reason to come together other than to create a larger market, advance economies of scale, improve relations. So there's not the same powerful motive. If you simply look at the preamble of the European Union, it refers to the peoples of Europe coming together to create a new solidarity, a new European, a new sense of Europe. If you read the preamble of the North American Free Trade Agreement, it reads as if it was written by Lily Tomlin, a Canadian comedian who once wrote, "Together we are in this alone." It's three sovereign states defining the most minimal conditions for creating a market rather than creating a vision of what the three countries could do. Now, I'm not blaming the authors of NAFTA because NAFTA itself was a huge leap from two centuries of protectionism and wariness and defensiveness. But I'm blaming the leaders that followed for not building on that platform and going forward. And I'm blaming Americans for not asking themselves a simple question that applies to the case of North America and to almost every issue on our agenda. And that question is, can we learn from other countries? Because Europe, while different, has also approached a number of challenges of tremendous relevance to where we're at right now. And I'm not arguing in the book that we should replicate their policies or their institutions. I'm saying we're foolish if we don't try to learn from their experience and ask ourselves two questions. One is, how to avoid their mistakes? And secondly, how do we adapt their successes? In other words, even in their successes, I wouldn't argue we adopted what they've done, because I think the two markets, the two sets of countries are very different. But nonetheless, if they've succeeded, why don't we learn from that and ask ourselves, how do we adapt it to the different part of North America? So I think the question is a hugely important one at many different levels, not the least of which is, as Americans, when we deal with a public policy issue, we ought to learn to ask ourselves some fundamental questions like, can we not learn from other countries? Because we've stopped asking those questions.
So, Dr. Pastor, if I understand your supposition, I mean, NAFTA, when it was passed, did what it was supposed to do. Where it went off the rails, if I'm understanding correctly, is our post-9/11 reaction. And as a former security expert, where do we stand on these security issues? How can we address those concerns so that this level of cooperation between the three countries can be jump-started?
Well, excuse me. NAFTA didn't go off the rails. The three countries of North America just didn't address the new sets of issues that emerged since NAFTA. And my argument is we should actually stop talking about NAFTA. It's no longer directly relevant. And it distracts us from a whole set of new issues that are out there that we need to deal with, one of which is security. The truth is we have long been talking and propagating, and indeed some of the websites to this day talk about how the U.S.-Canadian, U.S.-Mexican borders are the longest undefended borders in the whole world. Well, that was true up until 9/11. But now they are very defended. The number of officials on the U.S.-Mexican border have increased by a factor of six. On the Canadian border, even more, but it started. There were only 450 border people on the U.S.-Canadian border over a 4,500-mile border. It was said, of course, these are mostly Canadians and Americans. And the major defense that the Canadians used was an orange cone to prevent any terrorists from crossing the border. But that had been very successful up until that time. And indeed, there's no evidence that it isn't been successful since then. Because the interesting point is, and I went to, in the course of the work, I went several times to the Tijuana-San Isidro, San Diego border, which is the border most crossed by people in the world. 65 million people a year cross that very thin line. And I asked the head of the Department of Homeland Security on the U.S. side, how many people, because I was actually pulled aside on one of my things and put into secondary because they saw my passport. I visited the Middle East, and they were very concerned about that. And I asked him, how many people have you arrested on suspicion of terrorism on this border since 9/11? And the answer, zero. Now, instead we keep building up those borders. Now, I think it's this fear that something can happen that as Tom Friedman has said, is going to ultimately lead us all to have to completely undress when we go on airplanes from now on. He came up with a new airline called Fly Naked. But I think at some point we have to step back and ask ourselves, is this, all of the security we built into the system, is it really rational? And are we doing this in the most efficient way? And I think the answers will be obvious, no. And I think we also need to approach these security problems more from a trilateral standpoint. Even though there are two separate borders, it's always good to introduce a third country, a third neighbor. And the reason is very simple. If it's U.S., Canada, U.S., Mexico, the degree of power difference is so huge, and it's a binary decision. It's you either do it my way or you do it your way, and we're not going to do it your way. But if you have a third country there, you could say, well, actually, there's a third way here. Maybe it might not be so hard. Maybe six inches difference is not enough to keep us from cooperating on how we do this. So I think security is a major issue. I don't believe we've handled it very well, and I don't believe we've made any progress. I think if you have a commercial vehicle and you're trying to trade between the U.S. and Canada, and most of these firms are just mom and pop firms, you need almost 10 separate forms and identification cards, which can cost you up to $250,000 a year. To cross that border. And as a result, more than half of their companies have been driven out of business in the last decade. So there's a simple way to do that. All you should need is one form, one ID for both borders. It would be much more efficient, and it would be much cheaper, and it would improve commerce, and it would piss the Canadians and the Mexicans off a little less.
Thank you. I'd like to remind our listening audience that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to The North American Idea, the vision for a continental future with Dr. Robert A. Pastor. Stronger union with Canada and Mexico makes so much sense. What are the biggest obstacles right now to making that happen?
What's most interesting is I have a chapter in the book on public opinion in the three countries, and I look back three decades. Because the real danger of public opinion is people tend to use them as snapshots. In March of 2008, our Democratic candidates looked at a snapshot public opinion poll in Ohio and found 80% of the Democrats who were going to be voting the next week for the presidential candidate were opposed to NAFTA. So they came out swinging. But if somebody had bothered to show them three decades worth of polls, they would have seen this was a very unusual moment, that by and large, Americans, Mexicans, Canadians liked each other. They were becoming more alike with each other, and they actually thought NAFTA was a benefit to all three countries. They also agreed that NAFTA benefited the other countries more than them. All three countries agreed on that. And that tells you a little bit about trade and public opinion. The overall conclusion on public opinion is that actually the American, Canadian, Mexican people are interested in a bolder approach to North America than the leaders. And so the obvious question is the one you've just asked, which is, what's the obstacle then? What's holding us back? And the answer is that 15 to 20% of the people in all three countries are very vociferously against it. They are the Lou Dobbs, and the Bill O'Reillys and the Maud Barlows in Canada and the PRD, López Obrador in Mexico. No more than 15 to 20%, but they're the loudest. And the way our political systems tend to work is we give more weight to the loudest than we do to the general public until you find a leader who's willing to mobilize the general public and then go forward. And the arguments of the loudest and the most strident are we're losing our sovereignty, the Mexicans are overrunning us, you know, all issues on a rational basis that you could contest and you can discuss and you can help people to understand and you can reduce fears. But that group is not that open to rational discussion, as I've discovered when they send me emails like, you know, I'm going to kill you and your seed, and if you ever step out of your house again, you know, we're going to arrest you and we're going to throw you to Mexico or someplace like that. This is not a portion of the population that's open to rational discussion, but they have a potent effect on slowing this debate down.
And then the other sort of gorilla in the room, when we look at especially relations between Mexico and the United States, is the drug problem. And how do you see that playing out over the next decade and in relationship to your vision, or, you know, where are we going to go on that front?
You know, we had a drug problem between the U.S. and Canada in the 1930s. It was called Prohibition. And it led to unbelievable amounts of violence in Chicago and Detroit and elsewhere. I don't remember that. That's not really a big problem anymore, I don't think. I think we eliminated Prohibition, and sure enough, that went away as a problem now. Drugs are a little bit more insidious, there's no question. And the degree of violence and fear and the grisliness of the killings in Mexico are very serious. And there is no simple panacea to this, and I wish I had it. But I can't tell you that I know what that is. And I've consulted experts who know a lot more about this subject, and one of them is in our room right now, Ms. Mathea Falco, who is Assistant Secretary in charge of International Narcotics Affairs in the State Department. There's no simple solution to this problem. I think partly we need to understand that there are several transnational issues that can't be solved, but they can be managed better. They need to be placed in context. We need to understand more fully that we're at least half of that problem of Mexico drug violence. We are at least half in the sense that we're the consumers. We're the source of all of the money going into Mexico, therefore the source of the corruption. And most significantly, because it's the one thing we could do something about, we're the source of the weaponry. You know, 80% of the 80,000 weapons that were captured by the Calderon administration in the first 4 years of their war came from gun shops. Within 50 miles of the U.S. border, we have 7,500 gun shops within 50 miles of the U.S. border. Now, I testified before Congress, and I said to congressmen, I said, how would you react if American kids were being shot with guns that were coming from the Mexican side of the border? And I think they all fled for the bathroom when I asked that question. But I think we know what the answer to the question was. We closed those gun shops down, and that's what the Mexicans are asking of us. And we can't even get the gun shops to report multiple sales of AK-47s to the drug cartels. We can't even do that. The National Rifle Association has such a hammerlock on the Congress and the executive branch that we can't close down gun shows. We can't stop automatic weapons and high-velocity weapons that we use in wars to be sold to drug cartels. So we have to acknowledge that if we can't solve these easier part of the problems, we can't blame Mexico for having a hard time solving its side of the problem. But to the extent that all of us get back into this game together, and we bring the Canadians in, because the Royal Canadian Mounties, as we know, at the minimum, will absorb the gunshots better with their red jackets on. But they also have some other ideas that have worked a lot better in Canada than they've worked in the United States or in Mexico. So I think this needs to be a North American idea. I think we need to put it back into context. You know, right in Los Angeles Times, 80% of the articles coming out of Mexico City over the last 6 years were on drug-related violence about Mexico. Mexico is the 11th largest economy in the world. It's the largest manufacturing country in Latin America, larger than Brazil. It is a great force and a dynamic country, and all we see, because we're not looking very hard, is drugs and violence. I mean, that is a reality, but it's not the whole reality. So we need to look at Mexico a little bit better than we have.
Thank you. And so, you know, where are we right now in terms of the three governments in collaboration or coordination? I mean, is it all taking place in world bodies like the World Trade Organization? Are there direct tri-party talks on certain sectors?
Well, in August of 2009, the three leaders met in Guadalajara. And they had a nice luncheon in Guadalajara, and at the end they issued a nice communique, virtually the same communique that I've read for the last decade or so. And in that communique, they pledged that the next year the summit would be in Canada. The next year was 2010. There was no summit in Canada. Then they pledged the next year after that would be in the United States. That next year is this year. And as of 2 days ago, when I asked the State Department if there had been an announcement yet of the summit, the answer is it's coming. Yeah, I said, but in what decade is it coming? I think there is a possibility they may put a lunch together if we can get at least a little bit of a couple more op-eds, maybe could do it. Who knows? At the end of the APEC summit, which will be in Hawaii in November, but that's not enough. That's not enough. There are basically we reverted to dual bilateralism. We have set up a commission on the border initiatives with Canada. We've set up one with Mexico. We set up a commission on regulatory conversions with Canada. We set up one with Mexico. We're not really talking trilaterally. We don't have an agenda. And the government, like previous governments, measures progress by the number of bureaucratic meetings. Well, we're doing really well because we just had this meeting and we had three different visits and we've done these other meetings, but they never talk about results because there have been no results. And that's where we're at right now. We're not anywhere right now.
Again, I'd like to remind our listeners that this is a program with the Commonwealth Club of California, and you're listening to the North American Idea, the Vision for a Continental Future with Dr. Robert A. Pastor. Does the Obama administration infrastructure initiatives in any way sort of give support to your vision? Would this be a good way to sort of start that dialogue? I know that
it would be a great way to start. I mean, the overall goal, in my judgment, is to create a North American community, not like the European community, but a community in which all three nations recognize a simple fact. Which is when your neighbor's house burns down, the value of your house declines. And when your neighbor's house has a nice renovation, the value of your house improves. And the same applies to our three countries. If Mexico does well, we benefit. Mexico and Canada came out of 2009 recession faster than us. And as a result, our exports to Mexico and Canada increased $80 billion. Now, that's just the increase. The total value of trade was over $1 trillion. But that increase exceeds our total trade with South Korea, Colombia, and Panama, the three trade agreements that are before the U.S. Congress. So do we want to try to negotiate and think about a North American community that will benefit all three countries? In my judgment, there is no single leader in the world who would be better at negotiating and articulating a community than the most well-known community organizer in the world today, Barack Obama. He just needs to open his eyes beyond the borders and see our connection with our two neighbors. And he needs some advice in that direction as well, which he apparently has not gotten yet because he has a lot of other things on his mind, undoubtedly.
And, you know, you touched on this, on the U.S. recession that began in 2009, or we started coming out of, I guess, in 2009. Tell us what happened to illegal immigration from Mexico. I mean, as we were in the doldrums.
Undocumented migration soared over the last two decades to less than 1 million to over 12 million by 2009, two-thirds of which come from Mexico. And I think it soared for a variety of different reasons, the most important being the income gap and jobs in the United States. I have a part of a chapter which I talk about the Postville, Iowa attack that occurred in 2008, March of 2008, when Black Hawk helicopters descended on a kosher meatpacking processing plant in northeast Iowa, Postville, Iowa. And I asked myself, this is very interesting. They arrested 369 immigrants, most of which were from Mexico. And I said, this, if we look closely at this one incident, it appears to overturn a picture of conventional wisdom. The first thing about it is, you know, what is a kosher meatpacking plant doing in Iowa? You know, Ross Perot had warned us that American factories would be going to Mexico. He didn't say they'd be going from Brooklyn to Iowa. And he didn't say that the factories that went to Iowa would then employ Mexicans, and why then aren't they coming down from Chicago and Des Moines? What is it that allows Mexicans to know about factory openings in northeast Iowa that the Americans living in Chicago or Des Moines, a few hundred miles away, they haven't seen the same advertisements and they haven't been able to do that, and they're not even advertisements in Spanish. So that the most interesting of all is the Minutemen, which are a small group from Southern California who are responsible for patrolling our borders and also for watching for UN Black Hawk helicopters landing to take our sovereignty away. They've been watching the skies for that. And in this case, the Black Hawk helicopters came in and they applauded. So there's something wrong with this picture. There's a lot more that's wrong with the picture on undocumented migration, and it's a very complicated issue. But the truth is, as you correctly pointed out, in the last 2 years, enforcement has increased and unemployment has increased as well in the United States. In Mexico, however, their growth rate has been two or three times that of the United States, and so therefore not only are there fewer Mexicans coming in, there are more Mexicans staying. Now, what should one conclude from that? Number one is the income gap matters. If Mexico can grow for a decade at twice our rate, they will close the income gap by 22%. Mexicans will recalculate their interest of coming across the border looking for jobs, and they would stay at home. So it's in our interest to work with them to create those jobs in Mexico. Secondly, enforcement does matter, but the truth is that we're not doing it very well. We're flailing. There is a comprehensive set of proposals that are out there, and nobody can wrap their arms around all of the parts of proposals. And that's because we're fundamentally ambivalent and divided, as individuals as well as a country. Republicans, on the one hand, they like cheap labor. On the other hand, culturally, they don't like the Mexicans coming in. So they can't figure out. Democrats, for example, they want to appeal to the Hispanic population politically. They're sympathetic to their plight. On the other hand, they're competing against unskilled workers who also make part of the Democratic constituency and hurt those workers by taking jobs which maybe they would take if the wages were a little bit higher, as they would have to be if there were no workers coming. I mean, those people argue that people, Americans won't fill the job, are asking themselves the wrong question. The question is, if the wages were higher, would Americans fill the job? And I think the answer is probably yes. But as long as employers can pay lower wages for much more mobilized workers, as undocumented migrants are, because they're afraid of getting kicked out, afraid of being turned in, and because they come from a place where they could work just as hard and not make any progress. That's the beauty of the American dream. You can work hard and make progress. So the short of it is that you're quite correct. We've seen a slight change on the flow of undocumented migration in the last couple of years. But that won't last. and therefore we need to come up with a comprehensive plan for doing it, and most of the pieces are out there right now. And we need to cooperate with Mexico for dealing with the long-term issue of this income gap.
Thank you. And then, you know, how do we move beyond blaming, you know, other countries for each other's problems? I mean, what's going to inform that debate so that we can move beyond these irrational fears and mistruths?
Well, obviously, when the economy is doing very badly and people are very fearful, they tend to take it out on others than themselves. I mean, there's a funny thing about international trade. If you ask a company doing poorly what the cause is, they will largely probably say imports. Although if you then ask them, well, there is a competitor across town who's doing actually very well, how could it be imports? And they still say it's imports. If you ask a company that's doing very well across town, what's the cause of it, they will rarely say it's because of free trade. So there's an imbalance in the debate. And fear has a way of overtaking hope. And if you succeed, you tend to attribute it to your own genius. And you fail, you tend to attribute it to others. So that's sort of built into the human condition. What you need is you need compensating mechanisms. And usually you turn to leadership for doing that and to explain to people that, you know, we can solve our problems and we can solve them even better if we cooperate with our neighbors. And our neighbors are actually doing more than we are to maintain this relationship. And let me point out what they're doing because you may not be aware of that. And we need to do more of that. So I think it's leadership. And I developed this in the book. Incidentally, there are books still available out there and in your bookstore on Amazon.com, the North American Idea. And there are many more interesting anecdotes and stories and a lot of data, too, for you to either read or enjoy or avoid if you'd like.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where there is time only for one last question. And Dr. Pastor, help us out here. What can we be doing now? I mean, you know, people either here in the audience, people listening to this broadcast, you know, what are some of the immediate sort of small steps that we can take to kind of realize this future that's to our great benefit?
I think the first and easiest thing is just to look at your neighbors differently than you did before, and that's why I start with an idea, because I think that's really quite important. I have, and I found, you know, when I travel internationally, I often feel a camaraderie. I felt this much for the first time about 15 years ago with Mexicans in Spain. And that was an interesting place to do it because, you know, Mexicans used to think of Spain as much closer culturally, obviously linguistically. But I think in this trip I met a lot of Mexicans, and they always felt as if more of a camaraderie and more of a solidarity with me as an American than even with the Spanish. And I think if you look at public opinion surveys, you can see the Mexicans are thinking of themselves more and more and closer to the United States. You know, we have this stereotype, the Mexicans, you know, hate Americans. It's not true. You know, if you look at public opinion surveys, they actually like Americans more than any other Latin American country. They trust Americans more than any other Latin American. They actually trust Americans more than they trust each other. And the people they trust the most are Mexicans who live in America. So I think the first and easiest step is to look at our neighbors differently and to begin to think of new ways that we can cooperate. My idea for the president would be very simple. Given this time of austerity, I'm not talking about money, very simple, start by calling for a summit in the United States, a whole day, using that as an opportunity to educate Americans to why Canada and Mexico matter to us, why we want to build a North American community. Invest in education. Get our students at an early level to read about Canada and Mexico in a different way. Right now, there's maybe a paragraph maybe on Canada, if you're lucky, in our textbooks. Maybe two or three paragraphs on Mexico, but mostly those are Mexico is in the way of our manifest destiny, but we overcame that. But there's nothing in those that say that these countries are the most important in the world for us. And go beyond that, have regional study centers on North America. You know, we support 88 regional study centers, the federal government, very little amount of money. I think, you know, not more than $100 million for 88 regional study centers all over the country. And those are studying Africa, they're studying Europe, they study Russia. There's only one region that the U.S. government does not support, and it happens to be North America. $5 million a year could allow 10 or 20 universities to apply to get a grant, 100 universities to apply. That would stimulate research, courses, a new generation wanting to study in Canada and Mexico would begin to change things. Then finally, just ask your ministers of transportation, oh, by the way, come up with a plan on North America. You know, we'll worry about the funding later, but let's see a continental plan. The truth is that all three countries have had stimulus packages with infrastructure, but they weren't even national plans. They're local plans. Now think broadly, think continentally, think the way Franklin Roosevelt did when he asked for an inter-American highway connecting Alaska all the way down to Chile. Let's think about a new corridor in North America. Let's think about the North American idea.
Our thanks to Dr. Robert Pastor, author of The North American Idea, The Vision for a Continental Future, for his comments here today. We also thank our audiences here, as well as those listening to the recording, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, commemorating its 108th year of enlightened discussion, is adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.